Stephen Patterson uncovers a forgotten creed found in Christian Bibles that is radically egalitarian.
The cliche went something like this. I thank the fates every day that I was born a Greek and not a barbarian, that I was born a free person, not a slave, that I was born a man and not a woman. Those three categories define privilege in the ancient world. And so whoever composed the creed, and we don't know who did, but whoever composed it decided that she or he would turn those categories on their heads. There is no Jew or Greek. There is no slave or free. There is no male and female. A disclaimer of privilege.
I discussed with Stephen Patterson his book, The Forgotten Creed, Christianity's Original Struggle Against Bigotry, Slavery, and Sexism. It's time for Progressive Spirit. Stay with us.
Smiling face, outstretched hand, through disputes, small and grand, we will lay down our guns. We are one. In the rage, through the war, we have shared pain before. In our grief, when it's done, Urinin Hana, Urinin Hana, where the earth touches sky, we are born.
For the Pacifica Radio Network and PRX, Public Radio Exchange, and from the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon, this is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm John Schuck.
We have seen in our own day and time now the enduring power of race and class and gender as a means by which to divide people one from another, to turn people against one another, and thereby to gain power. And not only have we've seen it work on Christian communities in a particularly powerful way. When Donald Trump was elected president, it's well known that evangelical Christians, but Christians across the board, have supported him in by large majorities. He probably would not have been elected without the support of evangelical Christians. So when race, class, and gender can be used so effectively to motivate Christians to vote against others, to vote for a person who would exclude others, who would discriminate, it's time to remember our roots, I think.
In the studio with me is Stephen Patterson. Stephen Patterson is a professor at Willamette University. He's the George H. Atkinson Professor of Religious and Ethical Studies at Willamette. As a historian of religion, he specializes in the origins of Christianity, especially the hidden histories found in books that were not included in the Bible. He's authored and co-authored 9 books and more than 100 essays, articles, and reviews. Steve was last on this program about 4 years ago. We were talking about The Lost Gospel, or The Lost Way. Mm-hmm. The Lost Way was the name of that book. Welcome, Steve, to Progressive Spirit.
Thanks, John. Good to be here.
Glad to have you back. Now, that was called The Lost Way, right?
Yeah.
Tell me about that book again.
Well, that was a book about two lost gospels that have been discovered, so to speak, in the 20th century, namely the Gospel of Thomas and a gospel that's still lost, namely a thing we call Q, the lost gospel, and how they are, the study of those two gospels is really rewriting the story of Christian origins for many, many scholars. So that was that book. That was The Lost Way. This is The Forgotten Creed.
The Forgotten Creed. And that's the new book that's just come out in 2018 that we're going to be talking about, called The Forgotten Creed, Christianity's Original Struggle Against Bigotry, Slavery, and Sexism. So The Forgotten Creed is the verse that is very popular among the liberals, I would guess. I would say the Galatians 3:28. We talk about that a lot.
Right, right. This is a book about a text that's, as you say, quite well known among what we used to call mainline Christians, liberal Christians. But for most of Christendom, it's forgotten as a creedal statement anyway. And it's located in the Epistle to Galatians, Paul's Galatians, chapter 3, verses 26 through 28. And this little piece of text is actually something that Paul dropped into this letter, something that existed before he wrote the letter, a creedal statement, probably from some kind of early baptismal liturgy, if you will. And Paul just drops it in. So it's a pre-Pauline creed. You could call it a Christian creed. But before Paul, there weren't really Christians. So it's a creed of the Jesus movement. It's remarkable insofar that as it does not speak of all the things we might think of as creedal subject matter, like the nature of God or the nature of Jesus Christ. It doesn't talk about salvation, any of those things. Instead, it talks about the followers of Jesus and who they are to be and how they are to understand themselves in relationship to others.
So this book, The Forgotten Creed, so how did this book come out now? Is this something, is this information you've known for some time and decided to publish the book now, or is there a... Tell me a little bit about the circumstances regarding this book, The Forgotten Creed, and being published today.
Well, it might strike you as somewhat timely. For those of you who don't know the text we're talking about, I'll just give it to you so you have in your head what it is. In Paul's letter to the Galatians, it appears like this. For you are all sons of God through faith in Christ Jesus. For as many of you as were baptized into Christ have put on Christ. There is no Jew or Greek. There is no slave or free. There is no male and female. For you are all one in Christ Jesus. That's how Paul gives it to us. And he's obviously adapted it there for his own use. And so part of what I do is I reconstruct the original creed, which would have gone something like this. For you are all sons or children of God. There is no Jew or Greek. There is no slave or free. There is no male and female, for you are all one. And so you can see it's about, this creed is about race, class, and gender. There is no Jew or Greek. That's ethnicity. There is no slave or free. In the ancient world, that's class. That's the basic class distinction, slave, free. There is no male and female. That is, of course, gender. So race, class, and gender are the categories they're working with, and claiming that these categories are human constructs. They simply are not real. They don't exist. And that was the basic claim that these followers of the Jesus movement were making. So you might think it's a pretty timely subject matter for our own day and time when race and class have become fighting words, especially in the political climate this year, and gender more than anything else, perhaps, also. But I didn't choose the subject for that reason. I chose the subject 3 or 4 years ago when I realized that no one had ever really written a monograph, a book on the whole creed. There have been very good studies of pieces of the creed over the years, but no one had ever taken the creed as a whole and tried to explain it for folks and where it comes from and, you know, what it means in its three parts. And I just thought that was fairly low-hanging fruit, and it's about time somebody looked at it and explained it to folks because, as you say, among liberal Christians, it's quite a well-known piece of Scripture, and people want to use it, and if they want to use it, they should understand it.
It's a well-known piece, but I certainly didn't know it as you explained it, especially as you are articulated, well, from the source of it before Paul. I kind of thought it was, I didn't really think much about it. I just kind of thought it was a nice thing that Paul said compared to all the obnoxious things he says.
Right. And it's too bad to take one of the nice things and take it out of his hands, I suppose.
But that's part of the deal. He's writing this letter, but it hasn't anything to do with the creed itself. Right, he's not. This letter of Galatians is not explaining the creed.
No.
He's using that to prop up a particular point, and it's only one of those three.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about what Paul, how Paul uses it, and then go back?
Yeah. So the letter to the Galatians is about Jews and Greeks, and so Paul's big thing was he thought that non-Jews, Gentiles, let us say, could become part of the Jesus movement without following the Jewish law, especially the part where, if you convert to Judaism, you have to be circumcised. That was the real problem. And so he wanted Gentiles to become part of the Jesus movement. So he said, well, Gentiles don't have to be circumcised. And that was the dispute that Galatians attempts to address. People had argued against him. Most people in the Jesus movement disagreed with him on this point. And so Galatians is that argument. So in the middle of that argument, he drops this creed into the letter. And maybe it was a creed he expected people to know. Maybe some of them had been baptized, and so they heard the creed then. Who knows? But he drops it in, and he wants it just for the first of these dyads. There is no Jew or Greek. So there is no Jew or Greek. There is no slave nor free. He's not talking about slave-free stuff in this letter at all. There is no male and female, not on his radar in this letter. So he drops the creed in for that first piece. There is no Jew or Greek, and the rest of it just comes along for the ride, so to speak.
And so this, first of all, let's talk about parts of Paul's letters that predate Paul. How much of it is that? I mean, if 1 Corinthians 13 might predate Paul, right?
Maybe, there's certainly a little piece of it that does, yeah.
And there may be some other pieces, too. Is there something we can reconstruct, or is it just so disparate?
No, the Pauline letters are, as you can imagine, they're much, much studied by scholars. So a lot of this has been parsed out fairly carefully. And there are several pieces that are clearly identifiable as pre-Pauline set pieces, some of which he composed, some of which others have composed. And this is one that others probably composed, not him. And also there are things in the Pauline letters, drop-ins, that actually come after, that are later than the original composition, so later interpolations, we call them. So when you're reading the letters of Paul, you got at least three layers you got to pay attention to. One, you got pre-Pauline material that he's incorporated. You've got then the letter, but then you've got post stuff also that comes in, is added by later authors.
And this early creed, though, it's really a radical creed. As I read your book, we're talking about so radical that probably never was carried out very well.
Yeah.
Slave or free. And when they were talking about those, we're not just talking about, well, we can ask you about this. This isn't just spiritualizing, right? Well, in Jesus in heaven, there's no Jew or Greek or slave or free.
No.
It's a spiritual sense, but in the real world, it's the categories still count.
Right.
How do you see this creed being before Paul as an original creed of the movement?
Well, I think it's important to think about the creed as defining of that pre-Pauline Jesus movement, because we don't have a lot of material from that early period, the first decade and a half of the Jesus movement. So it's a little hard to know exactly what they were about. So these pieces that come from that period are really important. This creed is actually built on an ancient cliché. And it's a cliché that goes back to, there are Greek versions of it, very old versions, ones attributed to Thales, some to Socrates. There are Jewish versions of it. There probably were as many versions of this cliché as there were ethnic groups in the ancient world. And the cliché went something like this. I thank the fates every day that I was born a Greek and not a barbarian, that I was born a free person, not a slave, that I was born a man and not a woman. And, those three categories define privilege in the ancient world. Native-born rather than foreigner, Foreigners were always at a disadvantage wherever you went. Free, not slave, that's obvious. Male, not female, that's obvious. So this defines privilege in the ancient world. And so whoever composed the creed, and we don't know who did, but whoever composed it decided that she or he would turn those categories on their heads. And so the creed undoes that, disclaims that. There is no Jew or Greek. There is no ethnic distinction. These things just should not exist. There is no slave or free. That class distinction should not exist. There is no male and female. Even gender distinction should not exist. So this early Jesus movement embraced this idea. We could call it radical egalitarianism, if you will. But more than that, it's a disclaimer of privilege. And it involved a kind of solidarity between those who had nothing and those who had a little or had something. And these communities, these early Jesus communities, would be communities of solidarity. So the last part of the creed is, for you are all one. Not, by the way, for you are all the same. They're not claiming sameness or we all have to be alike, but they wanted to claim oneness, that is solidarity.
Because you talk about it quite emphatically in the book, that this is about power relations.
Yes.
It isn't about just people getting along. Well, slaves get along with your masters. No, there's a power redistribution here.
Right. You know, the last really good book on this, on the creed, was by a Jewish scholar by the name of Daniel Boyarin, wonderful scholar. He wrote on There Is No Jew or Greek. And he was writing really about that part of the creed in terms of modern identity politics and noting that in a Christian culture, if you say there is no Jew or Greek, you're just saying there is no Jew.
Everybody become one of us.
Right, yeah. It's all about sameness and wiping out cultural difference. And in the history of Christianity, that is certainly true. But when you put there is no Jew or Greek in the context of the whole creed, then it really becomes a different issue. No slave ever celebrated the difference between slave and free. It's no slave or free is clearly about power. It's about privilege. It's about freedom. It's about being a fully human person, being, as the creed itself says, being a child of God, just like everybody else. So I think that the creed as a whole is about that. It's not about identity. It's not about, celebrating identity. It's about celebrating solidarity or claiming solidarity, the necessity of solidarity. In a concept they would articulate as being a son of God or being a child of God.
I just finished coming back from Iraq for Arba'in, the pilgrimage to the shrine of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet, who was murdered. And all along the way, people embraced me as being a Christian, and I heard again and again, brothers in faith, equal in humanity, that there is something that this creed lives on, perhaps within Islam itself.
Yeah.
And so, but I want to go back because there's something that's carried through there, that there's something primal about this creed that goes back to, I think, perhaps religious identity itself at the highest level.
Yeah.
So you said it goes to the Jesus movement. This come from Jesus, obviously inspired by Jesus?
Yeah. I would say it probably is inspired by Jesus, a certain understanding of Jesus. There is a strong thread in the Jesus movement, love your neighbor, but also love your enemy. One of Jesus' best-known stories, of course, the story of the Samaritan who stops to help is the story really of an enemy who stops. And so there is this thread through the Jesus movement that claims basic humanity for everyone and describes the idea that human beings should be divided one from another, friend from enemy. So I think it does come from Jesus. It's possible also, however, that it comes from John the Baptist. One of the things about the origins of Christianity that is kind of a mystery is where baptism comes from, because Jesus himself didn't baptize anybody. John the Baptist was the baptizer, and yet somehow Christians end up baptizing one another. And so it's possible that the creed comes from that early Baptist movement or some version of it, some branch of it, as those were the people who were baptizing, not Jesus himself. So I've played with that idea. It's hard to know where it comes from, but it's certainly adopted by the early Jesus movement as definitive of who they are.
If you're just joining us on Progressive Spirit, my guest is Stephen Patterson. He's the George H. Atkinson Professor of Religious and Ethical Studies at Willamette University, and he's the author of the book we're discussing today called The Forgotten Creed, Christianity's Original Struggle Against Bigotry, Slavery, and Sexism. And this creed, a baptismal creed, what that means, it's important when you are the baptism, one would think, is the very identity of what it might be to be part of this new community. And so this baptismal creed doesn't have anything really to say about God, except children of God, things about salvation or any of all of those kinds of things. It has to do with really a new social and power structure of how to live as human beings. Is that fair? Right off, is that right?
Yeah.
It's huge. So, for example, we think of, you write in there about Paul. He wasn't necessarily talking about justification of faith, you know, in a spiritual sense to get to heaven. It was related to this creed.
Yeah.
How did that play?
Well, the first clause in the creed, of course, is there is no Jew or Greek, and that's what Paul is interested in, because that is what, in this letter, in the letter to Galatians, because that was really definitive of his whole, which we say, orientation within the Jesus movement. Paul says when he became part of the Jesus movement and this kind of mysterious transformation that happened with him, he said, God revealed his son in me, somehow, what we should understand that to mean, but he revealed his son in me in order that I might proclaim him among the Gentiles. And so scholars of Paul today take that very seriously and understand that Paul, when you read Paul's letters, it becomes very clear that he's not really interested in, salvation per se, in the same way that modern Christians are. What he's interested in is justification, that is how you can be in right relationship to God. And for Jews, that involves observing the covenant with God, that is following the law. But he says for Gentiles can be, non-Jews can be in right relationship to God just by being faithful in the same way that Jesus was faithful, in the same way that Abraham was faithful. And so this is the definitive thing for Paul, including Gentiles in the Jesus movement without having to observe the Jewish law, especially circumcision. And that part of the creed is maybe the only part that was ever really tried in Pauline communities. It was tried and ultimately successful, at least for a while. Paul was very successful, and lots of non-Jews joined the Jesus movement until, say, in the second century, most people who are in the Jesus movement, most people who are Christians by then, are not Jews. They're Gentiles. But then, of course, the idea that there is no Jew or Greek, there is no Jew or Gentile, falls victim to Gentile anti-Judaism and eventually Christian anti-Judaism, and Jews fall away. And that part of the creed, there is no Jew or Greek, just becomes there is no Jew. There's no longer Jew among
us. Yeah, well, this creed certainly has been forgotten in practice in terms of Christian practice throughout the centuries, as you mentioned. But for Paul himself, this was a central part. It wasn't like an add-on. He was about making real peace, get rid of the enmity between Jews and Greeks, which had been pretty intense.
Right. Where Paul was working, you know, especially in the early part of his life as a follower of Jesus, was the Eastern Roman Empire. And in the 30s of the Common Era, so 35 to 39 or so, this was a very tumultuous time for Jews living in the Eastern Roman Empire. The first anti-Jewish pogrom happens at this time in Alexandria, one of the great cities of the Eastern Roman Empire. And one of the stories I wanted to tell in this book is about very similar anti-Jewish riots that took place in the city of Antioch, another city of the Eastern Roman Empire, where Paul himself was very active. And The events that I describe in the book probably took place when Paul was in Antioch, or maybe just prior to his coming to Antioch. And what Paul was dealing with was two rival communities in Antioch, one Jewish, one Greek, that did not like each other, that were rivals. And in about the year 38 of the Common Era, so just before Paul was really becoming active around there, Greeks rioted and killed hundreds of Jews, ransacked the Jewish community, destroyed synagogues. And in response, a Jewish general named Phinehas from Tiberias, actually, a city outside of Antioch, rallied a number of mercenary troops, Jewish mercenaries. They marched on Antioch itself and destroyed the Greek community, killed many people. And so there was a kind of civil war in Antioch for a few weeks until the Romans finally intervened and sent everyone back to square one, arrested Phinehas, put his head on a pike outside the city gates, and tried to make peace. But those communities, the Greek community and the Jewish community, went on from there in utter animosity. And those are the circumstances in which Paul comes to that city and says, Jews and Greeks should, ought, need to sit down together, at least to begin to try to create a community in which this hatred is dispelled. So table fellowship, eating together, becomes the symbol of Paul's attempts to bring these two communities together in the name of the Jesus movement. So what the Jesus movement meant to Paul was that these two communities that hate each other could actually sit together and eat. That was defining for Paul. That was that set him on a course for his entire life, the rest of his life, trying to create communities that were mixed ethnic communities, both Jew and non-Jew, Jew and Greek, Jew and Gentile, Jew and Roman, Jew and Galatian, the Galatian communities. So this is absolutely central for Paul and the whole meaning of the Jesus movement for him.
This is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm speaking with Stephen J. Patterson. We're discussing his book, The Forgotten Creed, Christianity's Struggle Against Bigotry, Slavery, and Sexism. More to come. Stay with us.
What do I do now? Could we start again, please? I've been very hopeful so far. Now for the first time I think we're going wrong. Hurry up and tell me this is just a dream.
You're listening to Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm speaking with Stephen J. Patterson. We're talking about radical egalitarianism in early Christianity. I want to move to that second dyad of slave and free, because as you write in the book, it's slavery was just assumed by everyone, perhaps even Jesus, yeah. Perhaps even Paul. And even the letters, and certainly as we get to the forgeries of Paul, Timothy and Titus, who really are super reactionary about Paul's views, but even him himself, he wasn't necessarily saying we can stop slavery.
Right.
And so how does this, so who could dream up a creed that says neither slave nor free when we haven't done this we can say we haven't done this in America since the 1860s, and frankly, there are slavery by another name certainly exists throughout the world today.
Yeah.
So certainly great deals of class divisions. So I'm kind of curious on were they really thinking that? Because could people have really thought we could live without slaves?
You know, that seems like such an easy thing for people today. There is no slavery, of course. But that's because we have written slavery out of our history. We don't understand the extent to which Western civilization has been a slave culture all along. I've just been reading Jill Lepore's book, These Truths, her new history of the United States. And our telling of American history has excluded the history of slavery and the role that slavery played in our own civilization. And so we don't really understand our civilization very well because of that. And this is true also of ancient civilization, Roman civilization, these great cultures from which Western civilization descends. We have our laws from Roman civilization. We have so many customs. Our language ultimately derives from Latin. But the Roman world was a slave culture. It was a slave economy. The estimations about how many people were enslaved in the ancient world vary, but it varies over time. But roughly a third of the Roman Empire would have been enslaved at any given time. And if you include then people who were freed slaves, people we called freedmen or freed persons, which is kind of a quasi-slave status, these weren't really truly free people, you'd get up, you know, at another 30%. So a majority of people in the ancient world were burdened with the status of slave. And so their ancient economy depended on this too, by the way. So slavery was like the third rail of ancient discourse. You cannot talk about slavery. You cannot advocate slave rebellion. You can't advocate ending slavery. These are all things that can get you into deep, deep trouble. And I think Paul understood this. Who would have written a creed that said there is no slave or free? Probably a slave. You know,
yeah,
frankly, and or someone who was, you know, in solidarity with slaves and willing to take that risk. We don't see much evidence for that in the Jesus tradition. We don't see much evidence for it in the Jesus in the sayings of Jesus, the stories of Jesus. Jesus himself does not seem to have uttered a word against slavery. At least we don't have anything preserved of that nature. So, again, this is an insight that we have to thank an anonymous person who was in the followership of Jesus, who just decided that, you know, the implications of what Jesus taught are, there are no slave or free. The distinction between slave and free is not a real distinction, and we should abolish it. So this is an idea that doesn't go very far in the Jesus movement.
Well, when you have figures like Aristotle, You know, justifying slavery as a part of some people are just aren't bright enough. Their souls don't have enough reason.
Right, right.
You know, that kind of silliness that actually ended up lasting centuries.
Well, until the modern period.
Yeah.
Aristotle's argument about slavery persists until the 19th century in American discourse about slavery.
So this person who made this creed, or persons, is really going against the grain.
Yeah.
Were there any instances at all that you know of in Christian history in which this became real?
There were. We have to kind of read between the lines to get to them. One of the places, of course, is Paul's letter to Philemon. It's a very short, tiny little letter he writes to a guy named Philemon about Onesimus, who most scholars think was a slave that belonged to Philemon and had run away from Philemon. And so, for whatever reason, Onesimus, the slave, has come to Paul. Now, maybe he's come to Paul for clemency. Maybe he's come thinking that Paul will protect him or ask Philemon to free him or something like that. So there's a little glimmer of some ideology within the Jesus movement that said slaves could find shelter. Unfortunately, when Paul writes to Philemon, he doesn't say clearly to Philemon, free Onesimus, you should free this man. He's very coy about what he wants. He just doesn't say it. He almost dissembles. And so Paul himself doesn't really have a firm conviction about this. At one point, it even seems like, in Onesimus, some scholars will argue that he wants Philemon to give Onesimus to him so he can be Paul's slave. He can serve Paul. So it's not even clear that Paul, in principle, objected to slavery. So this creates a kind of ambiguous legacy about slavery that going forward that makes it impossible for Christians to have any firm convictions about slavery. But we know there were places in early Christianity where slaves were freed. One instance is in an obscure letter of Ignatius of Antioch. He writes to the bishop Polycarp and says, you know, you should not allow the common fund to be used to purchase the freedom of slaves. Or I guess what he says is that slaves should not ask to be freed using the common funds.
Meaning that it was at some point.
Meaning that it was. So at some point, Polycarp was overseeing a community in which the freedom of slaves was purchased using some common fund. We don't know anything more about it than that, but it existed.
And then there's a case in which it isn't necessarily the freedom of slaves, but slaves, as it was at Pliny the Younger, right, ran into these slaves and women who were leaders in their community while still perhaps slaves.
Yes. The first time we encounter Christians in non-Christian literature is in the first half of the second century in a letter of Pliny the Younger to the Emperor Trajan. And Pliny is a governor in a province, Pontus Bithynia. And he writes to Trajan about this group of people he's discovered. He calls them Christiani. Again, the first time we have this term in non-Christian literature. And they're disrupting society in his province. And so he wants to know what's going on with them, who they are, what they believe, what they're up to. And so he arrests two of their leaders. And he describes them as women who are slaves. And that little detail in Pliny's letter often goes unnoticed, but I think it's maybe the most significant thing you see in this letter, that this is a group that is led by female slaves. And in the ancient world, you do not get much lower on the social food chain than female slave. That probably also means, at the same time, prostitute, by the way. Or it could mean prostitute. Most prostitutes were slaves. So we know that at least that group was honoring slaves, was not respecting the difference between slave and free, and choosing as their leaders women who were also slaves.
And they were real leaders, right? They got the title, diaconus. What is the name, deacon?
Diaconoi. They are... deacons, if you will, and that is the ancient word we use to mean minister. So they're the leaders of this group.
Neither Jew nor Greek, neither slave nor free, neither male nor female is this dyadic creed. It's written poetically too, right? I mean, there's some thought putting into how it was written. So and that gives you evidence that this was used liturgically.
Yeah, that's how we recognize it as a creed. It has this nice formal layout. It's very beautifully formulated. In Greek, these three clauses are done exactly the same. And also the beginning clause, for you are all children of God, for you are all one. Those two beginning and ending clauses are both exactly the same also in Greek. So it's a nicely formulated piece. The only difference, the only glitch in the creed formally is in the last of these dyads, there is no male and female.
It's male and female.
Right, exactly. So it's neither Jew nor – there is no Jew or Greek. There is no slave or free. There is no male and female, not man or woman. And many scholars have noted that. And the reason it diverges like that and takes on those particular words, neither male and females, is that clause imitates – a verse in Genesis, the creation there, the first creation narrative in Genesis. In Greek, that is, as ancient Jews living in the first century would have known it, that says God created Adam the human one. God created them. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created him. And so the creed picks up that language from Genesis. And so this part of the creed, there is no male and female, hearken back to beliefs that many Jews had about creation. That in the beginning, human beings were neither male nor female, but that Adam was created male and female. That is, a kind of primordial, androgynous human being, a perfect human being. And only later was when God drew a rib from Adam's side, was gender created, a distinction between male and female, Adam and Eve. And this was the beginning of fallenness. Gender is the beginning of our humanity's fall from perfection. So to regain perfection, to go back to that primordial time when there was no sin yet, there was no rebellion, you have to go back to the time when there was yet no gender.
And gender, we're not talking about biology here. We're talking about power, right? We're talking about power relationships of because the role of women in civilized world, I mean, certainly since civilization has begun, has been one of inequality.
Right. Yeah, when people, when ancients talk about it, of course they talk about it in terms of bodies and dividing bodies and distinguishing male bodies from female bodies. But the talk of gender then, as it is now actually, is not really talk about sex. It's talk about roles and mm-hmm. what roles do men have? What roles do women have? And are those roles exclusive? Are they legitimate? And this is the territory that our creed intends to explore. That is, to claim that there is no male and female is to claim that women and men do not have different roles.
So how did this play out in, say, the early Christian movement, then within Paul, within Jesus?
Yeah, well, a lot of people think naively that Paul, in particular, was a misogynistic ancient male. And in the Pauline communities, women played virtually no role, no leadership role. But this is, in fact, entirely incorrect. Historians of early Christianity are almost unanimous on this today, that in the Pauline communities and in this very early period, women played a role equal to that of men. Even as late as the writing of the Acts of the Apostles, the description of how the communities that Paul founded came to be involves women. All of them, all the Pauline communities are founded by women or by women working together with men. And this is very reflective of what we see in the Pauline epistles, where women appear frequently as women, as leaders who have authority. Even a woman named, in particular, a woman Phoebe, who's mentioned in Romans 16, Romans 16 is actually a letter of recommendation for this woman, is Paul's patron. That is Paul's boss, if you will, Paul's sponsor. He's answerable to her because she is his patron. So women played a very important role, leadership role, in the Pauline communities and in other communities as well throughout the Jesus movement. That did not last forever, but it lasted quite a long time. And the dispute about whether or not women can be leaders in these communities erupts probably in the late first century and then really becomes a brouhaha in the second century among Christians.
And those who ended up controlling the narrative of Christianity, we might say, the Timothy Titus types, eventually became the word of Paul and the church.
Yes. The reason most ordinary, readers of the Bible, if you will, think that Paul was misogynistic and that women ought to keep silent in the churches and not have any authority, have that impression, quite honestly. They've just read the Pauline epistles, but they don't understand that all the letters that are attributed to Paul were not actually written by him. There are seven that were, but those that are not just weren't. So most scholars think that three epistles, 2 Thessalonians, Colossians, and Ephesians, we call those the Deutero-Pauline epistles, were not written by Paul. Some scholars will dispute Colossians, but most agree that those three are not written by Paul. And the other three that are not written by Paul, 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus, most certainly were not written by him, and they're written much later, as late as the middle of the 2nd century, but certainly by the beginning of the 2nd century, that's when those letters are being written. And that's where you really get the very clear statements about women and the secondary status of women, that women must keep silence in the churches. They are not to have any authority over men. This is 1 Timothy chapter 2, for example. And if women are to be saved, it is through childbearing, that sort of thing, where women must be part of a family. The person who wrote the pastoral epistles also advocated eliminating the historic roles for women, women ascetics, women who were unmarried. They called them widows, who had some kind of role, leadership role in these early churches, but the author of the pastoral epistles shuts down or tries to shut down that role. We don't know if he was successful or not, but he eliminates that role. And so that becomes then the legacy going forward, not only for Paul, but for all of Christendom. Christendom becomes a kind of patriarchal structure, assumes a patriarchal structure very similar to the culture that surrounded them, that is the Roman imperial culture.
And the same thing for slaves. I mean, the pastorals just say, slaves, be obedient to your master. Yes. I mean, pretty harsh language.
Yes. This is the order of the world. Yeah,
this is the way it works.
This is the way God has ordered things, and therefore you must be obedient.
So it's intriguing to think of some of the texts that didn't make the Bible, Gospel of Mary or some of these other ones. Is there a forgotten creed echo in any of those?
Well, yeah, to a certain extent. You know, if you were to sort of drop into an early Christian community in the second century and see what they were reading, the most popular text would have been something called The Shepherd of Hermas. Hmm. And most people have never heard of this text, but scholars know about it, of course. And the Shepherd of Hermas is the dreams and visions and narrative about Hermas, and who is a foundling. That is, he is a person who was abandoned at birth by his mother or father, his parents, set out to die, and someone found him, a woman, who raised him as a slave. This was a pretty common fate for children in the ancient world. If a family had too many kids, they would simply abandon the newborn child. Somebody might find the child and then raise it as a slave. So this is the story of Hermas. And then, so his visions and his writings, his ideas that are all in the Shepherd of Hermas, it's a kind of complex work. It comes from a lot of different periods and authors probably. But it's all framed around this guy who's a slave, who was a slave, and then is freed. But he has the ideas of a slave. He has the worldview of a slave. And this was a very popular work in the second century. And the stories in it, I would say, reflect a slave's point of view.
Hmm.
One of them, for example, there's a parable in Hermas. It goes like this. There was a man who had a vineyard, and he went away and left his slave in charge and said to the slave, build a wall around the vineyard, and when I come back, if you've done that, I'll reward you. So the master goes off, and the slave builds a wall around the vineyard. And this sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Yes, this is building a wall.
Yeah, this is a pretty common scenario, even in the parables of Jesus. Uh-huh. We've seen this before. So he builds a wall, and then he looks at the vineyard, and he says, this thing is in terrible shape. So he starts to cultivate the vineyard. And so he's doing more, right? He's cultivating, he's trimming it, and he brings the vineyard back to life and makes it a beautiful producing vineyard. And the owner comes back expecting the wall, but then he sees that the vineyard is also fixed up. And he goes, wow, this is just great. I am so happy with you. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. Not only am I going to reward you, I'm going to make you an heir to my estate. So he calls everybody together, including his son. Now you expect, dun, 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 right? Mm-hmm. What's going to happen when the son hears that he's got to divide the estate with his slave?
Yeah.
Well, I would expect now things to go very badly for the slave. The son's going to do something, right? But this is Hermas. This is the perspective of a slave. And what happens is the owner says, you know, I'm going to make this guy my heir. And the son, hearing this, rejoices, and they all have a big feast and celebrate.
Okay.
Happy ending.
Not so.
Not realistic, but a happy ending.
Sure, right.
Yeah. From a slave's point of view.
From the slave's point of view. Yeah. We just have about a minute or so left, but I want to really get kind of to a meaning of this modern times. If we think of Jew or Greek as obviously racism, let's say, or ethnic division, or ethnic power over, and obviously male and female of gender differences, and slave and free as economic differences, 1% versus the 99%, the rich getting richer.
Yeah.
This is creed is definitely relevant today.
Yeah.
Do you want to take a minute and talk about its relevance?
Well, yes, of course. This is we have seen in our own day and time now the enduring power of race and class and gender as a means by which to divide people one from another, to turn people against one another, and thereby to gain power. And not only have we seen it, we've seen it work on Christian communities in a particularly powerful way. When Donald Trump was elected president, it's well known that evangelical Christians, but Christians across the board, have supported him in by large majorities. He probably would not have been elected without the support of evangelical Christians. So when race, class, and gender can be used so effectively to motivate Christians to vote against others, to vote for a person who would exclude others, who would discriminate, it's time to remember our roots, I think. It's time to recall that there is a substance to Christianity. It's not just a political party. There is a substance to the Christian tradition. And that substance is quite at odds with all that we've seen in our own year and a half of very bad history, in my opinion, my humble opinion. So it's time to remember this creed, I think, and to embrace its idea that race, class, and gender are in fact, human distinctions that should not exist, should not matter.
And that substance is found in this book, The Forgotten Creed, Christianity's Struggle Against Bigotry, Slavery, and Sexism. Stephen Patterson, my guest on Progressive Spirit. Stephen, thanks so much for this book, and thanks for being with me today.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it.
Progressive Spirit is heard every week. On Progressive Spirit, you hear interviews with cutting-edge scholars, authors, and activists who have something to say about social justice, human flourishing, and things that matter. Progressive Spirit is formatted for radio and is distributed every week through the Pacifica Radio Network, the Public Radio Exchange, and Global Community Radio. Progressive Spirit is on the broadcast schedule of about 20 stations around the country. Ask your favorite station to add Progressive Spirit to its weekly lineup. You can download Progressive Spirit for free on iTunes, Google Play, Podomatic, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast app. The website is progressivespirit.net. Follow also on Facebook and Twitter. Progressive Spirit is produced in the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon. I'm John Schuck. Be well.